Throughout history, freethinkers have outraged the religious with their wacky ideas about the virtues of free speech, reason, and of course, eating babies. Now, God is dying, and it's time to dispose of his remains. From the pits of hell, Satan sends two puppets of the imperialist West and the Zionist Jews against God, Islam, and tiny kittens to bring you their propaganda and conspire for a new world order. This is Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment with Ali Rizvi and Armin Navabi.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment. My name is Ali Rizvi, and with me is Armin Navabi. As always, Armin, how are you?
Hello, I'm good.
Yeah. So today we're going to talk about Khadim Hussein Rizvi. So Khadim Hussein Rizvi, no relation to me whatsoever. Because I want to make that clear. So Khadim Hussein Rizvi was a very popular Pakistani Islamic preacher. He was known for his avid support of Pakistan's blasphemy laws and his hateful rhetoric against Ahmadi Muslims and other religious minorities. And one of the people, like, I think we have the perfect person here to talk about this. One of the people he was targeted by name was our guest today, Sean Thasir. So Sean's father was unfortunately murdered by, he was a governor of the largest province in Pakistan, Punjab, and he was murdered by his bodyguard. And the organization that Khadim Rizvi started, called Tehreek-e-Labbaik, was actually, it began in the aftermath of this murderer's hanging when he was executed. He was venerated. There were like hundreds of thousands of people at his funeral. And this organization was started as a sort of a pro-blasphemy activist organization. And now Khadim Rizvi has died, and his funeral, just like Mumtaz Qadri's funeral, had hundreds of thousands of people. Some people are saying it was over a million. And Sean, you saw those pictures of Mumtaz Qadri's funeral.
You said his organization was very pro-blasphemy?
Yeah, they're pro-blasphemy. They were against
pro-blasphemy law. So
yeah, pro-blasphemy laws.
Okay, so Ali, pro-blasphemy law, not pro-blasphemy.
Oh, sorry, yes, pro-blasphemy laws.
Okay. That's what right. We are pro-blasphemy.
No one's stealing your thunder.
Oh my gosh, we went so well, and I screwed that one. Yeah, okay.
But okay, good thing.
You saw the crowd, the funeral of Mumtaz Qadri, the man who killed your dad, and now you have this guy, and you see his funeral at Minare Pakistan Lahore, and it looks like there's over a million people there. What has changed? What is this ever going to change? How did you react to this when you saw this?
Okay, personally, I wasn't surprised. But interestingly, you put your finger on it. This is a political phenomena that is worth speaking about. Khadim Rizvi was one man. Mumtaz Qadri was one man. But the kind of crowds and the mainstream support that you see is a new political phenomena. This didn't exist up till 10 years ago. But it is the result. The seedbed for this has been laid out over 40 years. Through a few things, a failure of political systems, a failure of political processes, time and time again to address the lot of a certain, or to address the lot of all but a small sliver, a crust of people. That's one. So there's political failures, but there's also been a very active process of radicalization in Pakistan. Going back 40 years, going back to the time of the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, where Pakistan was treated like a recruitment clinic, a recruitment center for the Afghan war, with American help and with Saudi help, I might add. Now, an infrastructure of recruitment and training people was set up in Pakistan to sort of send them across the border to fight the Soviets. It was glorified then. It was called a grand jihad. They were called freedom fighters, all of that. And obviously, when the Soviet war ended, when the Russians left, this infrastructure wasn't dismantled. Now the way that you can convince a young man to sort of cross a border and become Soviet gunship fodder. The only ideology in the world that can make people do things like this is religious indoctrination. So anyway, so this has happened for 40 years. Those indoctrination clinics have remained. Those various madrasas that churn out people by the thousands with no skills except to become a prayer leader or to become a terrorist. These are the two skills that, you know, over a 10-15 year education out of a madrasa, people are churned out.
Yeah. And so that's, I would remind people also that that's where the word students, like the students of this madrasa, student in Urdu is talib, and Taliban, right? And it's, the word Taliban means students. And that's because the students of these madrasas, where they're being radicalized. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So this is a result of that process, and it's a long term process. But I think we should also see it with you know a global goggles on. This is the politics of nihilism. It's taking place all over the world. It's taking place in the U.S. with you know the Proud Boys, Antifa, in Burma the 969 Brigade, the RSS, Gaurakshar, in India the Ashike Rasool, Front National, the Alternative Germany, Alternative Deutschland, Golden Dawn in Greece. So there are sort of extreme groups, not just right-wing, but extreme left-wing also, like Antifa. Extreme groups arising all over the world with the politics of rejection, the politics of let's break the system. It's not so, and this is very different from any other from other political movements we've had up to 5 or 10 years ago. So it's the politics of nihilism, the politics of destruction. The system hasn't worked for us. So it's not like let's mend the system, let's break the system.
Burn it down.
Yeah. Burn it down. Yeah. So the phenomena of the Ashike Rasool is very similar to the Gaurakshar and the 969 Brigade in Burma. So it's a global political phenomena. And Khadim Rizvi is like that, the figure that arrives in a seedbed, which is ready for him. He was a fantastically charismatic man. In fact, he was the first leader, leader of the sort of right-wing religious groups that actually bought charm and charisma and oratory skills to sort of religion. He brought so basically he was a political savant. Yeah. He could entertain you. He spoke the language of the masses. Again, there's alienation from mainstream politics. I don't know if your readers know much about Pakistani politics, but for example, you've got not your readers, I meant your viewers. Mm-hmm. You've got, for example, the politics of Maryam Nawaz Sharif or Bilawal Bhutto, third generation
dynasty
legacy politics.
Right.
They don't speak the language. They, you know, of a lot of people don't really relate to them, and you know their promises now ring false. That you know, elect us for the 43rd time, and oh by the way, we've done so much for you all these years, and please re-elect us for the 43rd time. So there is a disheartening from mainstream politics, and that's where a charismatic leader like Khadim Rizvi arrives. And he speaks, you know, he speaks a guttural language. Yeah. There he abuses filthily like a sailor. So, Dalea, you pimp. Oh, you pimp, you. Yeah. So he sort of publicly abuses, his opponents. And then suddenly, and he's got the full spectrum of human emotions. So like, and then suddenly he'll revert to Urdu poetry. Hmm. And then he'll go to humor. And then suddenly flare into a rage again. So he kept the audience captivated. So he was a political savant, and he brought that to right wing religious politics, which was known for, you know, having the most hideous, dreary, boring leaders up to now. And suddenly this charismatic guy arrives. So he was a phenomena.
Okay, Ali, mute your mic when our guest is speaking, so there's no echo. Okay. So, is it But Ali, you mentioned that this guy, these people, he and his followers were pro blasphemy laws. That's kind of an understatement. It's like, you guys know, like, correct me if I'm wrong, but you know, these people wanted that. When we say pro blasphemy laws, we're talking death penalty here, right?
Right. Death penalty is also a understatement. The immediate lynching and death, the gunning down of anyone who's accused of blasphemy. So they wouldn't advocate for a trial or a judge, jury, straight to the executioner without the judge. And
vigilante justice.
Like that. In the case of Asia Bibi, for example, Asia Bibi had her day in court, and it was a court under the blasphemy laws that found her innocent. So if you're pro-blasphemy law, you'd say, well, blasphemy law has done its job and the law has found her innocent. Mm. But what they wanted was to trump the blasphemy law and make it an immediate case of mob justice by the street. Mm-hmm.
So is it safe to say that given how popular this guy was, and all his followers, would it be safe that to say that all these followers also would be pro the murder of the three of us here?
Oh, immediately. Yes, of course. In fact, it's a mini miracle that, that all three of us have survived since our last podcast.
And he's dead.
Yeah.
Alive. Well, he mentioned you by name, Sean. Like, he's saw a lecture of him talking about you. And he was talking about you, like, you know, I'm not going to repeat what he said about your father. And then, well, father was like this, the son is like this too. And he targeted you by name.
Yes, I'm one of the people he targeted, one of the many people he targeted, because I've taken a stand for victims of the blasphemy law, people who've suffered, people who've been to jail, people who've and remain in jail without trial, such as Asia Bibi, such as Junaid Hafiz. I've taken a stand for them, and I publicly opposed the blasphemy law. And on Christmas 2016, I gave a Christmas message and asked for a prayer for these people. And based on that, he gave a fatwa against me, a fatwa and calling for my death, my immediate murder. He didn't, these fatwas don't say arrest him and try him under the blasphemy law. They say, no, we have found him guilty and please murder him. And anyone who murders him will get a ticket to heaven. Now, the thing is that, you see, the case, the issue of blasphemy is political dynamite in Pakistan. It rouses such fierce passions that it calls a mob immediately to take someone's life. And it's something that can destroy your political opponents immediately if you so much as accuse them of blasphemy. So it's raw, unchecked power. And we know from human psychology that where there is raw and unchecked power, it will be abused. It won't be used in a benign way. Now the whole movement of Khadim Rizvi, Mumtaz Qadri, the Tehreek Labek, the Sunni Tehreek, has been a movement which has successfully capitalized on this political dynamite and forged a political movement out of it. And that, by the way, is the Tehreek Labek, which is his party. It's one defining feature from other parties, is their passion to kill in the name of blasphemy. In fact, Ashik-e-Rasool, which is people who follow them, are called lovers of the Prophet. And the moment, like your initiation rites into the Ashik-e-Rasool are not, I love the Prophet, therefore I pledge to keep the streets clean. I love the Prophet, therefore I pledge for economic growth and improvement in schools and well-being. No. It's always, I love the Prophet, therefore I will murder so and so and so. So it's a death cult.
I mean, it's on brand though when it comes to the Prophet.
Sorry, say that again.
I mean, it's pretty on brand though. Like when you say I love the Prophet, therefore I mean, it doesn't, cleaning the streets doesn't, is not the first thing that would come to my mind either. So it's pretty, it's pretty on brand.
Okay. No, but you, you'd think that a great religious leader, a religion of peace, I love my prophet means, oh, so therefore I'm a better person in this, this way. No, it's I love my prophet, so I will murder him or I'll murder her. So that's the, that's the initiation into the Ashqi Rasool, and that's the branding that sets it apart.
What
Go ahead.
No, what, what percentage of, I mean, I don't know, I, maybe there's no way to know, but what would you, is there a way to know what portion of Pakistani population would see this guy as a hero, as a good man, as a role model?
You
like,
you can never put a percentage on these things, because the cost, the not only to your life, but the social penalty of opposing it is so high that you'll only hear the voices on one side. It's a lot, it's like a lot of postmodernist woke stuff also, that you, so you think it's mainstream, you think it's the only view, because opposing it carries such a big social and possibly physical penalty,
right,
that that it's amplified beyond its real support, but there's no way of actually knowing.
But
that,
given the number of people that show up to support, you know, the millions of people that show up to either celebrate him or mourn his death, I would assume that the actual supporters are I don't know how many times more than the number of people that actually show up in the street. And if you just judge by the number of people that come up in the streets, it's already pretty high. I don't know. So is that like?
Well, yes, that you're right. That is one gauge, but there's another. There's another gauge, which is election results. And they won, they bagged about, what was it, remember, if I recall, 2 or 2.5 million votes, which is large for a party which is a year old, but it's a percentage or so of the grand vote. So if that is a measure, then it's, they are not in a majority, but it's like those belief systems where there's a noisy minority, and the majority will tip their hat for fear of be, of having their life destroyed.
So I think that's interesting, and it's also encouraging, because you know, one of the things you do see is you see Imran Khan, who the Prime Minister of Pakistan, who Khadim Rizvi also wanted to kill, by the way. So he was sending out very sympathetic condolence messages, you know, that, you know, this is a tragic loss, and I don't know what else he said in his tweets. And and that, I wonder about that gauge, because you're right about the noisy minority. Like I saw, I mean, in the US elections, you know, you're talking about the woke thing, and everybody thought that that's, everybody was going AOC. And then in the debates, you know, even sort of the moderate Democrats were scaling back a little bit. And later they realized, no, nobody wants this woke stuff. So they became bolder and bolder as the season went on. And it turned out that all of the rally attendance that, say, Bernie Sanders had, right, just did not translate into votes. It didn't. I mean, he got completely trounced. So it seems like there may be a similar kind of phenomenon there. In the elections, these sort of religious extremist parties, they never do well. They've never done well in Pakistan when the elections
Never. And I'm saying that if you add them all up and put them all – now, you know, there are – groups within groups and circles within concentric circles. But if you give them the ultimate concession and add them all up, which they never will in real life, even then, they don't make up, I don't know, I've heard different figures, but 10, some say 15% of the vote.
That's why they want mob justice. I think that's why they advocate for mob justice, for
Mob justice is street power. It is raw power. I mean, no one will oppose you. I mean, they can threaten the chief of army staff and the prime minister, and no one will really have the guts to oppose them, because that is where their power comes from. So okay, you know, and by the way, this, I also want to say, it's not, the mob justice is not just used to threaten opponents. It's also used to shape the culture in their, you know, in to their liking. So that's why in Pakistan, and there's been a steady decline. I mean, you had New Year's parties when I was growing up. You don't have them anymore. You had Basant. You don't have that anymore. Any kind of festivities or music publicly sort of exists under the arts exist under a threat. Any kind of liberal expression is threatened. 2 years ago, what was it? An elite school in Karachi wanted to sing a John Lennon song to world peace, and they were threatened, and they didn't. So it's also cultural bullying that they do.
Hmm. I don't get that much comfort by the fact that you guys are saying they're not the majority, because to me, I thought they were like 5%, and now I'm hearing 15%, and that's really scary. Because them having a deaf cult not being, I didn't ever think that they are the majority in Pakistan. But this is like a deaf cult that is, let's say, if there's 10% of the population, if they're as big as 10% of the population, we're talking a country of 200 million people, right?
Yes.
Like, we're talking 20 million people that want us dead. That's a lot of people. Any country that is cursed by 20 million citizens that want their opposition dead is like, I mean, how do you even address that?
I agree with you that their influence is huge, but purely mathematically, if you were to count them, they are not the majority. But yeah. Given the fact that, you know, you put 200 people in a room and one holds a gun and 199 don't, the guy holding the gun may not be the majority, but things will happen his way. It's similar to that. They are holding the threat of assassination, and like I said, it's nihilism. It's a movement that's sort of wanting the end times to come. They're sort of wanting destruction, and they're wanting murder, and for some reason they see that the great utopia, the great Islamic utopia, will sort of be at the end of all of that at some point.
But if, when we compare this to other countries, I don't think these other countries that have these crazy movements, I think these movements are more fringe in other countries than in Pakistan. I think these other countries, if you go to Greece, you don't have like 10% of the population wanting their opposition to die. When you look at the U.S., when you look at the woke cult,
Le Pen won 20%, the National Front won 20% of.
Austria,
a Nazi founded party in Austria, won.
Can you just not?
Oh my God. Sorry, Yahtzee. We're not supposed to say
that. Yeah, but you keep saying sorry, but it's already too late.
I know. I keep forgetting.
What?
But I'll get better.
Alternative for Deutschland does have Nazi roots. That's a fact.
Yeah, yeah. But the thing is, like, these guys, what they did in Austria, they won 46% of the vote just a few years ago, right?
Okay, like, they are bad, but okay, cool.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I'm not going to say things that is going to make... I just think that there are diseases and there are diseases. But I'm not going to make that argument.
No. Can I just say, that's an important point you made, that I agree with you, that even, what is it called, the Shining Dawn, the Golden Dawn in Greece, which goes around beating people up, by the way. It goes to places with minority neighborhoods and, you know, beats people up. Mm-hmm. Now, the only difference between them and the Ashike Rasul is that in their environment, the writ of state is stronger. In Pakistan, you've got perverse incentives because you've got a weaker state. I don't think the Golden Dawn, if you know, give them a state structure such as Pakistan, I don't think it's out of the goodness of heart that they just leave it to a beating.
Yes.
And also,
I agree.
With Pakistan, political events have conspired over 40 years to have made the global powers have favored the growth and nurturing of these groups to fight, you know, global wars. And
yes. I agree with that. We have seen what far-right movements do when they don't have any limitations, any structure, like any authority standing in their way. I completely agree with that. I also do think the problem with these Islamic movements are that they are very good at hijacking whatever social structure is at play. Way, like, when it comes to fascists, they are very good at losing very fast and losing the authority that they have. But when it comes to theocracies, they're a lot stickier. They're really good at infiltrating every aspect of government and society and staying along for generations after generations. Fascists have this non-theocratic fascists have a helpful habit of just destroying themselves really fast.
No, but fascists sort of tend to have existed in parts of the world with much stronger state structures and a much stronger, older history of organized democracy and the writ of state, and versus you know, the other side you're talking about, most of the Islamic movements, many of them work in ungoverned spaces, like the ISIS, for example, has no checks on its power. Would it be fair to say that the worst of the far-right movement, if they were in a position such as the ISIS, would they behave as badly? I don't know. Mm-hmm. We don't know.
It may be a cause-effect thing, right? Like a lot of these places, they may be ungoverned because the sort of the fascist elements of in these countries tend to have religion on their side. So when they have a theocratic sort of foundation, then that enables them to get more support from the majority. Like, for instance, you know, with Khadim Rizvi, right? Or say, you know, in another country, they ban YouTube, right? They say, no, YouTube is... Then it'll become a political issue. A lot of people will stand up. But in Pakistan, when they ban YouTube and they say, we're banning YouTube because there's blasphemy on here and it's against the problem, then you get the support of many, many more people who don't necessarily have fascist leanings.
Yeah.
The support. You can play the Palestine issue, you can play the Kashmir issue, you can play like Islamic sentiments, religious sentiments, and then that allows them to silence everybody, and it helps the fact that they stay ungoverned. So the fact that a lot of these places do end up becoming relatively ungoverned and they end up being like weaker states, maybe because
There's an element of that, but if I was to just with a broad brush look at the Middle East today, the biggest cause of you know, groups like the ISIS and is an illegal invasion of Iraq in 2003 by a you know, crazy, ridiculous, lunatic American president who thought God was on his side. It's an American invasion that destabilized all state structures, and all the monsters came out. We know that when you destroy, when you carpet bomb an area, you don't get a liberal democracy, doesn't come springing out. The worst monsters come out. So the people who will thrive in ungoverned space, thugs and religious bullies, and that's something that everyone predicted. If you looked at all the opposition to from intellectuals to the 2003 invasion of Iraq, it was predicted that this would happen, and it's played out like a script. So in terms of the immediacy of causes, war is something that essentially destroys state structures, creates a situation of civil wars. The worst monsters come out then.
Blonde Infidel in the live chat is asking, given that a loud and threatening minority can leave such a disproportionately powerful position, how do progressive types make headway?
Who'll take that?
Oh, that's for you.
Oh, okay. Okay, it's social change is not going to come from one group of people. What broke the plate is a confluence of many, many events. If we take Pakistan, for example, and repairing this situation is also going to take the will of many, many powerful power centers around the world. Because what's happened in Pakistan, the de-radicalization, this is not to take any responsibility away, but the crucible of de-radicalization that area became was also because many, many global powers, such as the Pakistan Army, etc., wanted such radicalization because it would suit their political ends. So many things are going to de-radicalize. It's going to take a generation. One of them, of course, is economic reform. One of the main reasons for for this de-radicalization is a complete marginal, the complete freezing out of all economic benefits for a certain class. Now, when you see the people coming to Khadim Rizvi and listening to him, they are also people who've been frozen out of all economic benefits from the fruits of economic growth that the region has had. And there are people who belong only to a certain class who will come to Khadim Rizvi, because there's a class issue at play over here. No poor person in a third world country such as Pakistan, when he's born, has his parents wishing that his son will grow up and become a jihadi. It's always things that go wrong. I know you raise an eyebrow there, Armin, but it's...
I've met some families that wish that, but okay.
I'll qualify that. Yeah. It is marginalization. It is despondency. It is a failure of alternative incentives that makes hordes and hordes of people sort of go towards these things. So to answer the question, it's many things, and it's something that's going to take some time, and it's going to be a will, and it's going to involve changing the zeitgeist in terms of what is acceptable and what is not.
Yeah, the main two elements is economic prosperity and activism.
Prosperity and activism are right up there. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Bulbul is asking, by the way, these are questions from our patrons. So if you guys are listening to the audio version of this later, consider becoming a patron so you could join us live here and ask these questions. Bulbul is saying, what do you see going forward? Khadim Hussein Rizvi seems like a symptom of a much larger problem. Yeah, that's a very good question.
Well, there's no doubt about that. Succession wars have already started. And between his son and his number two, a man called Pir something Qadri, I forgot it, Pir Afzal Qadri, who was his number two, his advisor and his son. So there's already a succession war going on, but there's absolutely no doubt about the fact that his death has created a job vacancy. And the kind of power, the political power, the dynamite power of this movement is not going to remain unfulfilled for long. Whether the successor is as charismatic as Khadim Rizvi, I don't know, but it'll be interesting to see, you know, who does
it's good for Pakistan that he died, isn't it?
I disagree.
Wow, why?
And I'm not saying it's good or bad for Pakistan, because these are long people come and go. Mm. I think there are much deeper current social and political currents that cause these movements. Khadim Rizvi didn't create this movement. He may have been a brilliant leader, but getting rid of him or him dying or another Khadim Rizvi is not the cause of these movements. These are just people who sort of who turn up to take advantage of these movements. But in the long run, I mean, I don't think it's a man that caused this.
Even though if the movement is bigger than the man, and the movement is not going to go away just because the leader died, isn't it a major blow to the movement that they lost such a charismatic leader? Like, isn't that a major blow to the movement?
Go ahead.
Sure. Perhaps a setback. But okay, put it like this: after seeing Mumtaz Qadri's funeral, and these were my thoughts when I saw it, I was certain that there's someone sitting somewhere looking at this funeral and thinking, wow, I mean, we could really marshal this kind of power, this kind of emotions for political gains. Yeah. And Khadim Rizvi was the man to come up. I have no doubt that there's any shortage of contenders to take that position. So Khadim can die and his successors can die, but this movement will find it's got underlying social and political causes which need to be addressed.
Sean, how do you feel about it? Because I mean, you're talking about this, it sounds like you're a little resigned to this, that this is inevitable, yet you do a lot of work with religious minorities who are victims of this whole system. Are you optimistic? I know that, you know, you've been working for Junaid Hafeez. You helped get Asia Bibi out, you know, with, you know, the campaigns. I mean, you were definitely part of that. You know, from your dad's, you know, you lost your father to this, and then you saw the funeral of the guy who killed
him. Yeah.
They saw this guy, Kadhim Zvikan, capitalize on that and then galvanize those, I guess, millions of people.
Yeah.
Are you optimistic at all? I mean, when you do the activist work, what motivates you if this movement is something that is almost inevitable, as, you know, there's nothing that can be done about it? Or do you think there's nothing that can be done about it?
No, this movement will remain for some time. But there's also a better Pakistan. So right. It's easy to look at this movement and think this is Pakistan. It's not. We do have our corner.
How do you bring that? How do you bring that out? How do you compete with those crowds?
I'll tell you what I think is important. We can't compete with the crowds, or at least I can't. One man can't compete with the crowds. But what we can do is that we can save individuals. We can save individuals who need to be saved. We can publicly show that someone stands in their corner. We can ensure that there isn't an atmosphere of despondency for a Junaid Hafeez, for an Asia Bibi, Mazhar Masih, and most lately for a girl, which I'll talk about, a girl called Huma, a 14-year-old girl who's been abducted and forcibly converted, which is code word for kidnap and rape. It is important, first of all, to help these people, to speak about these people. But I also want to say that there is another Pakistan that opposes this. There is a liberal Pakistan. There are a lot of people who oppose the Tehreek Labak. It doesn't speak for mainstream Pakistan, but it is louder. So to champion that cause and to be in that corner doesn't mean not accepting that the enemy is there and their power.
Right.
One thing that doesn't help, I think, is the absence of like countries like United States, North American countries, and Western European countries, and leaving a vacuum for countries like China to step in and become trading allies in such a way that less countries like Pakistan have to worry about having good human rights records to be able to be part of the global economy because of how influential China has become and how uninterested China is into having any standards for human rights with the countries that it's dealing with. And that level of independence from North American and Western European country leaves a lot of room for countries like Pakistan to just not worry about.
No, I disagree with that, Armin. I don't think the U.S. support for human rights is anything more than mere rhetoric.
I know. That's a failure. I agree.
Exactly. So it's not like sort of a growing Chinese influence in the region is going to worsen things. The United States, it's important, the rhetoric that the United States delivers, but I don't think it's a real counterbalance, because it's the United States also that supported General Ziaul-Haq, who, you know, over the sort of this dictator in the 80s that created during the Afghan jihad, during sort of this indoctrination period that I'm talking about, that sort of molded society in ways, the results of which we are seeing now. So it's the U.S. has a good sort of marketing campaign on human rights and things, but I don't think I don't think they are a real counterbalance to this.
No,
not to underestimate, not to understate sort of genuine good work, which mm-hmm. is there, but I don't think that's the thrust of their political involvement.
It definitely is not. I agree with you that. But there was a marketing department, even though it's not based on any consistency. In fact, you know, United States supports and backs dictators and allies with countries like Saudi Arabia, which are the main violators of human rights. Yeah. So, but at least there was a marketing department that pretended that they're on the side of human rights. When it comes to China, they don't even have to pretend. Like, they're like, you can rely on our support and you don't have to clean house at all, ever.
So
don't worry about it.
Some window dressing is gone. And yeah. We missed the window dressing.
I mean, it was better than nothing. It was better than, I don't know.
But Armin, here I want to say that Pakistan has a very sort of gallant record of fighting dictatorships, which isn't a U.S.-sponsored thing. Mm. So from the outside, their marketing sort of campaign is so good that you think that it's a U.S. thrust that leads to sort of upholding good values. But that's not that's not true in these theaters. You have a very liberal strain in Pakistani society, not just in terms of poetry and literature and society and sort of social movements, but also in terms of actual movements counter to these movements. 11 years while General Zia was there, it was you know, Pakistani movements that opposed General Zia. So I think these are homegrown problems which will be fixed by, which will eventually have homegrown solutions.
You're saying like, wait, so are you suggesting that, because I always had some hope, maybe naively, in a unity or cooperation between secular activists globally, regardless of borders. And I think a lot of people are skeptical of that because of the influence of, because of the ulterior motives of government getting involved in, with the excuse of promoting human rights. And a lot of people, rightfully so, are very skeptical of having, of any movement that is not grown internally, right? But what about non-governmental actors of activists getting involved, helping each other, getting united, learning from each other, supporting each other? Like, when we say that this movement has to be internal from Pakistan itself, are we talking about not getting non-Pakistani activists involved in this fight in Pakistan?
No. Non-Pakistani activists can't get involved in this fight. See, like in Pakistan today, the media, civil society, activists, journalists, writers, poets, are sort of like opposed to these changes that we are talking about. It's not like these things happen without any resistance. So there's a very active civil society and a human rights struggle in Pakistan. And I think that is what's going to create, as there is in Iran, and that is what is a counterbalance to these horrible monsters today. And when we see change, that is where it's going to come from.
I think, for example, a win in Iran against religious oppression would be a major boost to the same fight in Pakistan, or a win in Pakistan would be a major boost to activists in Iran. And that's why I see, like, I think, like, we could, working together as secular activists, I think that's the only way for us to continue. Ali, you seem like you want to say something.
Yeah, I wanted to actually add to what Armin's talking about, because, you know, we know about the civil society in Pakistan. We know about the sort of the secular liberal activists.
Your cousins are musicians, Sufi musicians, and, you know, rock bands, Sufi rock bands and things. Yeah,
exactly. So there's a lot of that happening. But a lot of the people who are working on this, like the most vocal ones, are outside of the country. So I want to know, there was a time when you could only work within Pakistan and you were limited in what you could say. But now with the internet and with social media and all these campaigns that you can do, you can work outside of the country. And like what Armin is saying, different people in different countries with these mindsets can actually work together. So how have you found that to be an advantage? I mean, because you're also working from outside Pakistan, and how effective do you find that to be?
Yeah, of course, everything helps. I mean, I can't, you know, you can't quantify it. It would be difficult to quantify it. All help or all contributions towards this matter in that they sort of turn the zeitgeist, the sort of dial of what is acceptable in a certain direction. But what I do want to say is that sitting outside Pakistan, it's easy not to see the liberal forces at work in Pakistan because the foreign media will never report on them.
Yes.
And the foreign media has no interest in reporting on them, on the various sort of the political struggles, the human rights struggles, etc., that take place in Pakistan. And I can understand why they wouldn't report on them, because it's very difficult for outsiders to understand. It isn't a straight line. It's a jagged line. It's a society that has its own way of functioning. You need to understand the society very well to be able to report on it. And for outsiders, of course, they require a broad brush approach. So they don't see the forces I'm talking about. But I would like, you know, I wouldn't say that the major portion of the thrust on, you know, against the counterbalance to these forces is going to or has ever come from outside. It's an internal thing. It's the liberal forces in the country. Some of them are civil society. Some of them are actually political
Gibran parties. Nasser, right?
That's just one name. Yes, and there are many, many others. There are many other writers, journalists. Sabine Mahmood being one of them. And don't forget, this is a country that this is a region that has brought down three dictatorships. It's also a region that had the greatest non-violent political movement in the history of the 20th century, which is the freedom movement of India and Pakistan, was essentially the largest non-political movement, non-violent political movement of the 20th century, perhaps in history. So that these traditions are alive and present and happening. You mentioned Gibran Nasser. There are Gibran Nasser is one of the very prominent people. But there's a host of other people in civil society and even in mainstream politics that oppose this. So the opposition is very much there and alive and kicking.
But, you know, when it comes to every country, when it comes to liberal activism, what I have seen is that I've always been shocked by how the strength, the detailed structure, and the efficiency of the existing liberal and secular activists that already exist that you don't hear about and that you notice almost every time I check that within a country, you see it gets no coverage. But if you actually go and take a look, you see that it's there and it has a long history of activism. And against all odds, they've been growing. Most of the times you could see that against all odds, they have been growing. When it comes to every other new country that I check before checking, I, based on my experience, I assume that it must be there. Like, so I actually have the opposite. My initial assumption is usually that it must be there and it must be stronger than most people realize.
Yes.
When it comes to foreign activists helping, there are a lot of people, a lot of activists that don't know this, think that they have to come and start something new, not recognizing that this has already been there for decades.
Yeah.
the role that I think that activists outside of Pakistan have is just to amplify the sound of the activists that are already there. So they do have a role. But if they are living in places where the limitation to freedom of expression is not as what the activists in these countries need is just so that they could be heard. They don't need a structure, they don't need new organizations, they just need somebody to take their messages and amplify it. And I think that's the role of people who are trying to help and that are living outside of those borders. What do you think?
Yeah, it's a noble intention, mm-hmm. but it can often be corrupted, mm-hmm. because you know this is also a phenomena that you know Arundhati Roy has spoken about, and I've seen sort of hints of it in Pakistan. Is that the moment foreigners come in, then you know they tend
backfires.
To corporatize mm-hmm. genuine activism. Often,
how do we avoid that?
How do you avoid that but let's just define the issue. Like when foreigners come in to foreign organizations come in into genuine causes and want to help activists, they kind of corporatize those movements, as in, you know, these are organizations with donors, with people working 9 to 5, often with less understanding of how countries work, and they're, you know, what you call KPIs. Key performance indicators are very set and perhaps sometimes bureaucratic. So they mm-hmm. can often take grassroots movements and convert them into elite. Sort of structured. They take something sort of inherently unstructured and convert it into something with, you know, a structure that sort of...
Is that always bad? Like, wouldn't it making it measurable and structured, could it also be
No, it's good also. It has its good and bad points. But mm-hmm. what I'm saying is that it's really where the rubber meets the road. It's not what counts. Mm-hmm. It's not what brings about real social change. Because, you know, real social change does not come from people who...
But how could you tell if you don't have KPIs where you can measure?
No, like, I'm not. I don't criticize foreign organizations at all. Of course, right. They have KPIs, and they, like I said, they are well intentioned.
Right. I'm just saying.
There's another aspect to this, Armin. Okay. There's that they.
But like here. So, sorry, I don't interrupt you, Ali. But here's ahead. The thing. There are organizations working in Pakistan. Foreign organizations with the best intentions, but limited for that sort of real understanding of change and how to bring about change and answerable to donors who want simple. When I say KPIs, I'm talking about simple things that can be put onto an executive summary and show that certain objectives have been reached. But how are you going to translate these things into KPIs? Hmm. I mean, you're talking about shifts in perception and changes in society. I don't think an organization with right. a KPI with limited understandings can really affect serious change. Though that doesn't mean they don't help.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just one sentence. As bad as simplistic as those might end up being, and as many factors that they're not going to be able to measure, I do think like they're often, not always, end up being better measurements that people's just perception, because that might be unreliable, but the most unreliable things are people's like, oh, well, my grandfather used to say this, and now my this new generation is saying that. Oh, I'm, you know, people, my taxi drivers are talking different. Like, I just think like other forms of measurement that people on the ground sometimes have are even less reliable than these other methods. You know what I mean? Like, they're not perfect, but sometimes there more structure is needed, but it depends on the situation.
Like for example, a foreign organization can't engage with the Ashke Rasool, can it?
No, it can't. No. That's the thing I was been trying to say over here, is that there's another element in this. And in Pakistan, foreign conspiracy, anything that's a foreign conspiracy, can be, that label can be tagged to anything. So anytime, you know, you have, say, a grassroots movement going on, right? And they end up getting support from some American, you know, humanitarian organization, however noble intentioned, it becomes an American conspiracy. I mean, these are people who thought that the polio vaccine, right, that was coming in was a way for Westerners to sterilize Muslims so they could.
There's a huge stigma to any kind of foreign help. In fact, it's career destroying. It will really destroy the career. How the stigma is.
A lot of times, like even when people, there are people who do reach out and they communicate. I'm from Pakistan. Like they don't want the secular activists and the liberal activists on the ground, the civil society people you're talking about. They all sort of distance themselves from the support of like-minded people overseas because they don't want to be seen that way. They don't want to be associated because they are trying to do things in a different way. They're trying to connect to the grassroots people and gain more support among them in a way that, you know, when foreign people come in, it becomes more counterintuitive. So that's there's also that stigma, which makes it difficult. But so one more question, and then we're going to go to some of the patron questions too.
We have to.
What is the burn down thing has been so effective? Because, you know, what we're seeing right now is whatever your majority is, it doesn't really matter. What matters is the person with the gun in the room. Is there an argument for civil society to at least have an element, like, you know, the civil rights movement? They had the Martin Luther King, but they also had the Malcolm X and the Black Panthers and all of that. And all of that plays a part together. So this is, I'm treading on fun ground here, but just in terms of, not saying you agree with it or not, but is there a potential for civil society, parts of civil society that had the same kind of militant fervor that these Khadim Rizvi types have?
Wouldn't that be fun?
Well, I mean, could it be effective? It has been effective in the past.
Ali, keep your questions short because we really need to go to the Patreon questions.
Short answer, no. Because the worst elements that you see are eventually part of a larger, like I said, bigger powers at play, essentially Pakistan Army, regional concerns, Afghan Jihad, the Kashmir fight. So these, most of these noxious elements eventually have the support of the boys in brass. So people sort of, you know, guerrilla tactics against them in urban Pakistan will meet a quick end.
All right. Yeah. So I'm gonna read the patron questions because Ali's audio is really choppy, and please try to keep the answers to these short. Bulbul is saying, how does Imran Khan figure into this narrative? Everyone thought he was a liberal, but his stance on France and his inability to protect minorities don't give me much hope. How would you answer that?
Imran Khan is appeals to a broad base, and you can't do that in Pakistan without signaling to these elements. And he does so. But it's a mixed bag of things he does. I don't agree with people who call him a supporter of these groups, because that's exaggeration. But he does politically pander to them, and is not very different from the two other mainstream political parties in power. Because anything you heard from them was just rhetoric, and they politically pandered to them as well.
Bulbul is also asking, Sean, your brother Atish means fire, wrote in his book about his half-brother who used to say, I effing hate Hindus, man. Was he talking about you? Is that the general rhetoric in Pakistan?
I can't, if that's directed towards me, I haven't said that. Is that the general rhetoric? Yes, many people say that. Many people, that's not the general rhetoric. There are elements who say that. There are elements who say that on the other side of the border. But I don't think that should be like a come away from Pakistan. But no, I don't effing hate Hindus. That's not true. I've risked my skin to stand up for them.
Exactly.
Blonde Infidel is asking, what if you have measures of success developed by local activists? So like KPIs by organizations that were built like locally?
Well, I'm sure you do. You do. But the reason I mentioned KPI is that a KPI is something that comes from the from a corporate world, where you can measure successes down to a simple number. What sales did you meet? What your your employee turnover was. In social movements, it's difficult to boil it down to simple numbers like that.
Right. Blunt Infidel is also asking, do you see a role for the Pakistani diaspora?
Oh yeah, a huge role. A huge role. I mean, more than just sort of people. Pakistani the diaspora is connected to Pakistan. They spend a lot of money. They send a lot of money back to Pakistan by way of remittances. They have a huge amount of political clout. All mainstream parties come to them, especially Imran Khan, to raise money for his political movements. These people have a lot of power if they were to use it sensibly.
But when we talk about the diaspora, we're also including the activists like Haris Sultan types or Ali Rizvi, and like that's also, you know, it's not just money and political influence; it's also activism, right?
Of course, I mean, they have a footprint in the pop culture and can use that responsibly.
Right. Shout out to Haris Sultan. Last question before I ask the last question, I just want to mention that the questions just came from our patrons. So thank you to our patrons. If you're not a patron, consider becoming one. So in the future live streams, you could be here live with us and ask these questions. Blonde Infidel is asking the question and saying, there's always going to be conspiracy theories. How do you try and deal with that?
Oh, you don't deal with them. There'll always be conspiracy theories. I mean, Khadim Rizvi's died. People, you know, are accusing all elements of either having murdered him. We don't know if it's corona. Conspiracies are a part of life. I mean, it's impossible to know whether you're in a conspiracy theory or not. So we can't deal with it. It'll be there.
You can reduce them by promoting critical thinking skills.
Oh, yeah, that we can. Sure. Yeah. But, you know, we'll get the right conspiracy theories out. The wrong conspiracy theories back. So
the problem a lot of times with this, you know, because we talk about critical thinking and so promoting the scientific method and critical thinking, the problem is who's doing it. You know, if it's being done by the people in authority, then people end up mistrusting that as well. Like they literally, Armin, in Pakistan, they look at this, say, oh, they're talking about freedom of speech and democratic values, science, critical thinking. It's because the elites are saying this, we can't trust it. They think of that as some sort of like indoctrination. So it's a very difficult issue.
Okay. Well, I don't know. Logical fallacies. Do we have people thinking, teaching logical fallacies is a conspiracy by the government? That hasn't become a thing yet. Teach that. I don't know.
Yeah, they're mobbing students in Peshawar University to death for asking questions about Adam and Eve. So long way to go before we start teaching critical thinking.
All right, guys, we already went over an hour, so we need to thank everybody for being here, and thank you to our patrons. Thank you again. Link to our patrons in the description. And where can people find you, Sean?
Facebook or Twitter, by my name.
Just
Sean Thatsir, at Sean Thatsir.
One word. With the name you see down there, one word.
Yeah.
You get in touch, guys. Let's start a dialogue. There's a lot we can all do. Many worthy causes in Pakistan.
Yeah, I like what you're saying about the Pakistani diaspora. I think we should talk about that and see, you know, if there's anything else. Anyway, we'll talk later. Anyway, so
the secular jihadists have been made possible thanks to the Illuminati and the covert support of Israel and the CIA. That's what we have been told, but we haven't received our checks yet. If you like what we do, please support us. Share the podcast with your friends. Write and tweet us with topic and guest suggestions. Or head over to secularjihadist.com and give a dollar or more for exclusive access to live video. Have your questions read and answered on the air and more. Till next time, may the flying spaghetti monster be with you.